So, the overwhelming experience I had when living here was in the absolute unshakable belief of the founders and of all of us, really, in the reality of the other world, in the presence of spirits, of the ancestors, and of beings from other planes of existence. And so now I'd like to become aware, open our awareness to the presence of the founders. Anna told us, and Lucy told us down in the Grove just earlier, it was Lucy who was talking about the meeting around the kitchen table in 1976, where there were seven of them, and Lawrence and Pamela and Olivia mentioned their desire to start the fellowship, and how it had been cooking beforehand, as it were, and that was the moment when it was sort of given birth into the world. And so I'd like to get a sense, where do you think Olivia and Derry, if they were here, where are they?
There's a few empty seats.
A few empty seats. Do you think they're sitting down here?
No.
She's there.
She's
around the dress. Yes. Okay. And maybe Lawrence and Pamela, Poppy as I knew her, and some people called her Bobby, didn't
Bobby.
She? Called Bobby. And,
yeah.
And so thank you Olivia, thank you Derry, thank you Bobby, for all that you've given, and we greet you and sense your presence. And I can feel Olivia now saying, "Oh, get on with it, Philip, now, thank you very much." But, because that was one of the tremendous qualities that Olivia had, is she could be away with the fairies, but utterly sort of practical and mundane and straightforward at the same time. And so I was lucky enough to live here for about 9 months in 1971. So that's 5 years before the fellowship started. So in thinking about what I can say in relation to the 40th anniversary of the fellowship, I thought I could just talk about really a little bit about my experiences here 5 years before it was born, and some insight into what was happening with Olivia too. Because when something is born into the world, as anybody who's had a child knows, something happens beforehand, before it actually manifests in the world. So in those 5 years, all the sorts of ideas and atmospheres and feelings that were circulating actually came to make up what the fellowship became. So I thought, let's look at what ingredients were in the cauldron that was starting to bubble and that would eventually produce the fellowship. And so I was 19 then, I dropped out of university. I'd been invited to come and live here. And I remember the last day, I had spent a fortnight here and working with Olivia in a new system of guided meditation that she developed. And it was utterly transforming and life-changing for me. And on the last day, I was sitting in the dining room and I said, "Well, thank you so much, but I have to go back now." And, you know, Derry used to sit there, Poppy used to sit there, and she just looked at me and said, "Why do you have to go?" And I said, "Well, I have to go back to university." And she said, "Well, where would you be happier?" And things started to move at that point, because I sort of sensed what was here. And I said, "Well, here, of course." And she said, "Well, stay." And I said, "Well, I can't stay. I mean, how long would I stay?" And she said, "You can stay here forever." And literally, it's one of the two times in my life this has happened. Everything started to swim. Because I knew that my life was about to change utterly and dramatically and drastically. And so I hitchhiked back to England, told my parents I was dropping out of university. They were furious, of course. Went to the university, packed my bags, and came back. And it was the best decision I'd ever made in my life. You know. So, and as soon as I came back here, straight away, at that time, Olivia and Derry and Poppy were calling it the Huntington Castle Centre for Meditation and Study. And straight away I found myself in a totally different world to the everyday outside world I was used to. And it wasn't just that it was eccentric, it was revolutionary. in the sense that everything here was turned upside down. What the outside world considered important was considered of really very little interest, and vice versa. There was a warmth, an acceptance here, and a tremendous sense of fun, a kind of amused view of the world that came from a certain detachment. I remember once sitting around the table and somebody saying, you know, Derry, when were you last in the village? And he sort of paused and he said, I think it was about 2 years ago. Actually hadn't been down to the village for 2 years. And the reason why there was this sense of fun, I think, this amused sense of detachment, was because there was a refusal to play the game of consensus reality. You know, there's this concept of consensus reality. We all agree that it's terribly important to be aware of what's going on in the world and politics and economics and all that. And there was just a refusal to play that game, and a refusal to fall under the spell of the collective trance. There's a way in which you can see our lives as being working through a sort of trance. We're in a sort of trance, seduced, locked into a certain way of understanding reality in the world, which is a sort of collective trance. And one of the most powerful values of a spiritual path is it's a way of waking up. That's why people keep talking about waking up, you know, because you wake up and you suddenly realize that the things that so many people seem to think are important aren't important at all. And you go through tricky patches when the transience of the world or the superficiality of the world or indeed the decadence or the immorality of the world is extremely depressing. And that's an important stage on the path, if you like, the path of disenchantment. But if one stays with it and if one has some form of spiritual discipline or some form of illumination that one can hold on to, then there's a process of re-enchantment, where different values, different ideals, different dreams inspire one, and what one can, in a way, fall into a different kind of trance, which was what was happening here. And the outside world places economics, politics, and science at the heart of its worldview. But at the castle, the priorities were entirely different. That triad was hardly considered. I can't remember any conversations about politics or the news. I mean, Lucy and Anna, can you remember when we sat around the dining room table, did we talk about politics?
Not at all.
Not at all? No. No, we didn't know what was going on. You know. And there was a wonderful moment, I remember this, where the word went out before the meal. There was a man from the Ministry of Education in the house, and that Derry had sort of got him in the library, but that he was quite obviously checking on what was going on, because all the kids were home educated, you see. So there were terrifying visions of you being carted off in a sort of Black Mariah or something to be educated, you know. So Olivia said, look, we've invited him for lunch. And what I want the most highbrow conversation possible, whatever you do. You know. So we sat down to the meal, and this poor sort of young, timid young man sat down with everybody, you see, and the food was prepared. And Olivia said, Philip, tell us about the time you were at the Picasso Museum in the south of France. And Lucy, what are you reading at the moment? Have you worked through all of the classics yet, or are you just still on the Iliad or something like that? So there's this ridiculous conversation going on. And we were all, you know, I was 19 and Lucy was 11 and Anna was, 16 or 17? 16 or 17, you know. So we were all desperately trying to keep up. Because the chap from the Ministry of Education was completely silent, looking terrified. Because, so he was obviously making notes and trying to decide whether the children should be allowed to stay or not. And then towards the end of the meal, he started to talk about the advantages of purchasing a complete set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. And it slowly dawned on everyone that he was actually an encyclopedia salesman. So as soon as he was out of the building, you know, the door was closed and everybody just broke into collapse and laughter. And it was such it was such a different world that we were in there that I can absolutely believe this story. It happened after I left, but a few years after I left, there's a story that you may know about how when Mick Jagger came to the castle, and you know he was showed around, you know the temple and so on, and Olivia said to him, "And what do you do, Mr. Jagger?" So she must have picked that up from the Queen, because that's what the Queen does. And what do you do, Mr. Jagger? And he said, "Well."
He came out to the kitchen and he said to Moira, and David came out the kitchen and said, "Can you take care of him? There's a chap there called Mr. Jagger and he's on the doorstep and he says he's a musician." Jack and Mindy.
After she showed him around. Oh, how marvellous. We must be asking, because apparently she said, you know, what do you do, Mr. Jane? He said, well I make music. And she said, and are you successful? I said, well, yes, quite successful. Yeah. So she said, fantastic, you know, how marvellous. And it must have been so refreshing for him to hear that. You know, I mean, because people in his position don't get that, no. You know. And I only actually realised this when I was thinking about this talk. I'd always assumed that Olivia had said that because she didn't know who he was. But if you remember Olivia, I think it's quite possible she did know who he was. And she was amusing. She was entertaining him in a sort of rather delicious way, pretending that she didn't know who he was. Either way, it's quite possible either way, really. You know, because the usual criteria of fame and fortune didn't hold sway here. You know, and economics had no part to play at all. You know, much to the exasperation of poor David, who was heir, clearly worried about how the whole show could keep on the road. And I remember in the dining room conversations about astral planes and beings from Atlantis and all the rest of that, occasionally there'd be a sort of sigh from David, who was sort of trying to sort of work out how on earth this whole gig could keep going, you know, given the fact that everybody was on another planet or from his planet. You know, how it could all hold together. You know. And what was deeply touching, I was invited to come and live here. Nobody asked me, you know, could you, you know, contribute some money? Could you pay for your stay? Could you work? None of those very obvious natural sort of considerations one would think of. It's just absolutely not in the equation. It was a gesture of absolute unconditional love, really, and welcoming, you know, which is an extraordinarily rare thing to experience on this earth, you know. And I think for me, one of the reasons it was so powerful is that having spent 18 years of being corralled, as it were, by the education system and all the rest of it, and then suddenly to be in a place where these criteria didn't apply, and it wasn't about that at all, was absolute balm for the soul. And as for science, bah! You know, it was so clearly topsy-turvy in its thinking because it never considered prime causes, which by definition were spiritual and not material. How, I can hear Olivia saying, can you purport to be scientific when you deal with only one plane, when there are at least seven to consider? You know, I can imagine poor old Richard Dawkins pitching up here, sort of making mincemeat of him, you know. Did anybody see that wonderful programme After Dark that Channel 4 did? Do you remember that? Yeah. It was, I think it was innovative. I don't think they've ever done it again. But what it was a programme that started at, I don't know, midnight or something. And it had no end time. They brought together about six people. They rolled the cameras. They had coffee and tea and drinks and all the rest of it there. And they filmed the discussion. And it just went on for as long as it went on. And it went on for a couple of hours. And there was a Satanist, a psychologist, a Christian priest, possibly even an evangelical Christian, I think, Olivia, what a great mix, and I think that was it. Oh, and Margot Adler, who sadly died a couple of years ago. And what a fantastic combination of people, you know. So, and of course, it was fairly stereotypical. The Satanist was kind of slightly spooky and slimy. The vicar was very sort of vicarish, and would try and come out with a biblical quotation that Olivia always knew the contrary quotation. You know, the great thing about the Bible is whatever you quote, you can say, but Ecclesiastes 3 says the complete opposite. You know, and Olivia knew this, so she would just counter every biblical quote with another one like that. Then there was an absolutely typical psychologist who was just totally confused by the whole thing. You could see him trying to apply psychological theories and none of them were working. He couldn't handle on anything that was going on. And Olivia running rings around, Margot Adler, very intelligent, very sensible lady, of course, and Olivia just running rings around everybody and being wonderfully entertaining. And such was the disdain for materialistic science, I think you could say. Well, never openly articulated, but just in the way things were just... But one way you could tell is that the whole show ran on a principle, but I don't know who invented it, whether it was Derry or Olivia possibly, that of the reverse Occam's razor principle. And so Occam's razor is this fundamental principle in science that you favour the simplest, most logical explanation. But Olivia explained to us that this was an extremely dull approach. And the way we had to operate was to always choose the most esoteric, the most fanciful and most exotic interpretation for anything. So I'll give you an example now. You see, if the door dramatically swung open there like that, Occam's razor would say, well, it's probably a draft, the wind, like that. But no, you don't need it. It's the least likely cause, and the most likely cause is a ghost who's eager to join our company. And, you know, what a great rule for life, try it. You know, when you go away, every time, every explanation must be the most exotic and most bizarre, the most esoteric. And what it means in practice is if you reply the reverse Occam's razor principle, is there's more colour, there's more laughter, there's more life. It's a re-enchantment of the world. So if the triad of science, politics and economics was scarcely considered, what was the focus of attention here? Well, it was another triad, which was a favourite of Olivia's. And it was the Platonic one of the three virtues, the beautiful, the true and the good. Which meant that the concerns here were for the humanities, for philosophy and religion, for art, culture, literature. And it, when it came to goodness, for being warm and generous. In other words, it was all about cultivating the virtues. Now, that, of course, sounds very neat and organised, but the Huntington Castle Centre for Meditation and Study, you know, was a spiritual school with a focus on the humanities. But, of course, it wasn't like that at all. What happened was much more organic and flowing and messy and undefined. And I think this scheme was there in Poppy and Derry's and Olivia's minds, but it wasn't expressed in a curriculum or explained anywhere. Although I do remember Olivia talking about this triad. So, and the basic stance from which everything else flowed came from a shared philosophy or worldview that the founders had, which you can characterise as idealist as opposed to materialist. In other words, this basic difference in philosophy of whether you believe essentially bottom-up or top-down. Bottom-up is that the world of matter is the real thing, and the world of ideas is simply an epiphenomenon, a sort of result of interaction between neurons, between people and so on. They come up with ideas. That's the materialist view, bottom up. Top-down one is the idealist view, which is that ideas, that spirit is the world of prime causes. And then the world of matter precipitates out of that ideal world. And that was the philosophy that the founders held to, the idealist view. And so from this point of view, the physical world, the castle we were bumbling about in, was a precipitate of divine mind. It was a projection of consciousness of the gods that we were living in. So it wasn't the hard, solid reality that most people mistook it for. Consciousness was not the byproduct of a fizzing between neurons in the brain. It was the foundation, the field into which consciousness itself chose to create what we call physical reality. And this is an idea that all of us who think of ourselves as spiritual probably believe. But at the castle, this perspective felt so utterly tangible. It seemed as if at any moment everything might dissolve all around us. If the deva or God responsible for dreaming us all into the valley here decided to roll over and go to sleep or got bored, we'd find it all disappearing in a puff of smoke and we'd wake up God knows where in Dublin or London or somewhere like that. Is it just me who felt that way? I mean, Lucy and Anna, did you feel as if it could all disappear in a puff of smoke?
Well, I don't know, because it's not very well.
I mean, you've been here much longer than I had, so...
It's like in that reading yesterday you did about when you grow up in a place, it's your world, isn't it?
Yes.
Your world begins and ends in that place.
In that place, exactly, and where and I'll read in a little place if we've got time from the plane of the two hounds where Olivia talked about that, because unlike you, she wasn't born here, and so she came here from Surrey. So she did, I think, have this very real sense of it being this enchanted place that might perhaps vanish at any moment. And I've only actually felt this feeling so strongly in one other place, which is in Brocéliande, in Brittany, funnily enough. And I think it's something that's found only in very special places, and perhaps a geomancer can tell us more about it. But undoubtedly, whatever naturally emanates here was enhanced, potentized even, by the founder's absolute faith in it. And we were talking I was talking with Minette yesterday about how the fellowship, I think, it grew out of a combination of the inspiration of the founders with this place. This physical location is extremely important. It's sort of helped to give it birth and was very much involved in the birthing of the fellowship. Its anchor, its grounding, the matrix out of which it came. So the primary stance, the first thing I think, you know, one has to say is, I came here to live in the castle. And what's the most important? It's this position. Positions are always so interesting because they seem, you know, well, you can take this position, you can be a materialist, you can be an idealist, but, you know, we've all got bodies, we're all living here, and would you like another cup of tea? It's like, no big deal. But actually, it's the deal. It's the major deal, because depending on which position you adopt, everything else flows from it. And so how you behave, how you think, how you feel, how you interpret your dreams, how you interpret interactions between people, all depends on the particular viewpoint you take vis-a-vis your life and the rest of the world. And the particular viewpoint here was the spiritual viewpoint, the idealist viewpoint. But it's not enough to say it's just a spiritual viewpoint, because we all know that spiritual viewpoints come in all shades of colour. I mean, you know, the other ISIS takes a spiritual viewpoint too, we have to say. There are fundamentalist groups take so-called spiritual viewpoints, religious viewpoints. So you have to ask yourself, okay, so it was a spiritualist, a spiritual perspective, but what sort of spiritual perspective? And I would say that it was one that was universalist, eclectic, liberal, that stood consciously in the stream of the perennial wisdom tradition. Yes. Universalist, and somebody mentioned that yesterday, I think, Kathleen, in your talk, and this was the primary stance. I mean, you just look at the Fellowship of ISIS material, you look at the first book that Derry compiled and so on. Seeing the beauty and the power and the value in every spiritual tradition, not just latching onto one. Seeing the divine in every stream. Eclectic, very happy to...
the butterfly.
The butterfly.
We are standing on the platform. What she did that later on, you know, her little place as a child.
Oh, really?
Yes,
really?
The same place.
The same place, how lovely. Yeah. And liberal in the sense of generous and open and non-judgmental. That's what I mean by liberal. And standing consciously in the stream of the perennial wisdom tradition. Now, this idea of the perennial wisdom tradition is there's this stream of tradition that comes from way, way back, that every mystic and philosopher is expressing in different ways, colouring it to suit circumstances and situation and audience as well, like that. And not just the Western mystery tradition, but the worldwide wisdom tradition. And that's another thing I think that the fellowship is absolutely in tune with, is, you know, we've been so used in the esoteric world and spiritual world to talk about the Western mystery tradition, the Western magical tradition, the Eastern tradition, oh, that comes from the East, oh, that comes from the West, and splitting things in that way. And whilst, of course, there's some value in seeing things and their geographical origin and so on, it's much more important, I think, now to tune into the idea or be open to the idea of the worldwide wisdom tradition. The worldwide wisdom tradition, because you all you have to do is scratch the surface of the Western tradition and you see inspiration from the East. Scratch some of the Eastern material, you see inspiration from the West and so on. And the perennial wisdom tradition, I see, is part of that worldwide wisdom tradition, and the fellowship and the founders stood firmly within that stream. And then, into that fantastic, stable, philosophical and spiritual position of universalism, drawing upon the perennial wisdom tradition, comes the inspiration of the goddess, the call to reawaken to the divine feminine that Derry heard so strongly he felt obliged to remove all references to the male god with a small scalpel in the library. And he was on a mission, and he either used a felt tip pen or a scalpel when at all possible. And there was a wonderful moment when the goddess inspired him to open up the corners. I remember I used to sleep in the little bedroom next to the chapel. There was a thin partition between my bedroom and the organ that was on the other side of the partition. And in a moment when I thought that I'd possibly gained enlightenment, but I wasn't entirely convinced, I used to meditate hours and hours and hours when I was living here. And one time I was lying in bed meditating, and suddenly this celestial music started to play, and I was illumined by light within. And I thought, this is it, it's happened. How fantastic, all these hours of work paid off. But then, closely on the heels of that thought were, well, if this is illumination, it's a bit, how can I put it, feels a bit tacky, a bit artificial. What's going on? You know, the music is a bit too churchy. It's a bit too the organ music. It's not. This isn't the sort of music I want when I gain illumination. And then I realised what had happened is Derry had come into the chapel and he was practicing on the organ. So it was do 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 like that, and the vibrations had caused a light switch in my room to go on. So the light had gone on. So I was lying there, bathed in light.
And then another time, the other time that Derry sort of came into the bedroom was one time I was asleep, and suddenly I was aware of a presence in the room, and I opened eyes, and there was Derry in his wonderful sort of raven's coat, which was this fantastic sort of tattered mac that had obviously been through about three generations, so it was in sort of shreds really, and he had a pot of paint. He said, "It's all right, don't wait, carry on sleeping, it's okay. I've just been told to open up the corners. I've been told that if I paint a thin black line down the corner of each room, it will open it up." And so there's this wonderful... So he sort of clambered over the bed and I sort of moved slightly. And he painted a line like that and did another line like that. And I sort of drifted off back to sleep and I had this lovely sort of semi-dreamlike state where I imagined the walls just opening. And he was right, you know. There was the space and the stars, all the stars came out in the night sky. Absolutely wonderful. I think they managed to stop him before he got to the library and you know, on some of the tapestry and all the rest of it. Please, Derry, don't do it. So this was the field that was set up. This was the worldview, the philosophy that guided the thoughts and the decisions and the conversations that took place at the castle. And this was the perspective that created the sense of joy and fun that was pervasive. The perspective that enabled us to laugh at the absurdities of life. To say effectively, whatever. You know, that deep wisdom that comes through teenage kids, you know, whatever. Which, it's sort of infuriating, but you kind of get it. You know, it's like, whatever, you know, it's detached. It's, you know, because it brings with it the ability to have a certain detachment or disidentification from those things the outside world so foolishly believes to be real. All this served the goal of the virtue of truth in our Platonic triad. So where was the beauty? Well, in the physical surroundings, of course. I remember revelling in the smell of the wisteria in the summer, walking by the river amongst the bluebells down on Tickies Island, hopelessly in love with a whole family, a whole landscape, a whole house. A love affair, I have to say, I have yet to recover from. For who, after spending an idyllic summer here, could be fully contented with living in a humbler dwelling, however comfortable.
And there was beauty to be found in another way too, which was Olivia's forte. It was her determined belief in the power of the imagination, her encouragement to express one's creativity, free of all doubt and judgment and criticism, that was infectious. And I think that was one of the most fantastic characteristics of Olivia, that somehow she'd managed to get rid of that little bird that sits on our shoulder. You know that one that says, you know, you can't say that, you can't do that, you've got the spelling wrong, have you checked the grammar on it, and, you know, is that really true? And all those sorts of doubts that we have. She had managed to get rid of that voice, and she just had that gift of just being able to talk. And you know, if she said something that she didn't believe as it came out of her mouth, she'd just correct it, in mid-flow, and or make a joke out of it. And that was infectious, it really was, and liberating. And it's important to know that this characteristic wasn't just confined to Olivia being encouraging to others and wonderfully productive herself. She also developed a particular technique for accessing the inner world of the imagination, the astral plane. She had developed a method that involved ritual, energy channeling, trance induction and guidance that was really quite extraordinary, and which she trained me in here and in London after I left the castle. And she first introduced me to her method in September 1970 on my first or second visit to the castle. And she guided me on these astral journeys for 5 consecutive nights. It was after I'd gone through these that Poppy asked me if I'd like to stay at the castle. And I agreed. So I came back in the new year in 1971. And then Olivia arrived in the spring. When she arrived with vim. And she would whisk through the corridor, sprinkling vim in all the toilets. And you know, Olivia's back. You know, she's
but not vim and vigour, no.
Yeah, it's vim and vigour. And so she came back in the spring of 71. And I had another series of sessions with her. And then in June, she taught me the method. And we then swapped roles. So, and at the time of the summer solstice, 71, Olivia took a series of 7 journeys every day for 4 consecutive evenings from the 20th of June. And then again on the 27th and 29th of June and the 1st of July. So what I'd like to do is read you some extracts from her notes. So it's quite something. We would go into the library after tea and take this voyage. And I would sit there and act as... She would be what's called a percipient, and I would be the operator. Before that, we were in reverse roles. I was the percipient, she was the operator. And then the operator would sit, like a psychoanalyst, at the head of the couch, with the percipient lying down, having gone through the ritual and so on. And you would make notes. And the power, beauty of this particular technique is that because you're sitting there, as the person goes off on their astral journey, you act like a link with this plane. So you say, what are you seeing now, Olivia? And in normal circumstances, you'd just go out. You'd be so deep. You'd come back. You might remember it, but you'd be just gone. And then you'd remember parts of it, or you might possibly fall asleep or just be blank. But because there's a voice saying, what are you seeing now? Just keeping you going. It keeps that thread. And as the operator, you're making notes. So, and then what we would do is write them up. And it would be the percipient's job to write a report of your experience. So every night she would go and type these up. So after the first session, she wrote, I was surprised, as this was my first time reporting as percipient, at the power of the whole method. My face felt stiff, jaws hard to move, voice felt remote and strange. There was no time to think, as one had to report back at once to the operator, so all had to be spontaneous. No time for daydreaming or the creation of fantasy. When the actual message came, I had an almost, yes, unpleasant pressure at the back of my head that I haven't experienced before. I felt I was being overshadowed by a being. It was almost too strong for me. The experience stopped abruptly, as I had certainly had enough. I was struck by the beauty of the words of the ritual. The message she referred to, and others which she received, were obtained from conversations with otherworldly beings. So let me give you an example of one of these from the second session that we conducted on the 21st of June. After travelling to a terrifyingly big pyramid, as she described it, and encountering various beings, she finds herself wearing a green robe, sitting on a mountain with the feel of Tibet, as she described it. She recognises a figure she calls the Tibetan. I ask her, what is his message? She replies, I think he once taught me brushwork. He says, all nature bears the divine signature. I have told you that forms on one level are the symbols for the higher. Whatever you see is a living witness to its own higher self. The personality is the hieroglyph of our own true being. Everything is a living language of the gods. All that is distorted is only the reflection on troubled waters of inner perfection. The moon shines in full perfection in its reflected beauty. In the turbulent waters of a disturbed lake, it shows a broken image. Which is the reality? We on earth are blind to the sky when we gaze down at shadows, our back to the light. We take the distortion as the real and hold the real to be a delusion. We can forever attempt to disentangle, to alter, to measure the shadows. Yet even as we look, they shift and change, and we are trapped by illusion. Turn then, my children, to the ineffable beauty of God, which you already know within yourselves, not as a reflection, but as your life. Wonderful, powerful stuff, isn't it?
Yes.
And then the next evening, on the 22nd of June, so one of those will have been the solstice day, as Olivia was gazing at an eagle in the realm she had entered, I asked her, how may we best serve? And she replied, to bring light. I asked, who is telling us this? And she says, Helios, many names. She says many names. We are to kindle dying fires anew in the hearts of men and women. We are to help the minds of men and women to receive true light. Insight for minds now often deadened by mechanical habit. We must be light bringers. I see the image of a flaming torch. How can we do this? I ask Olivia. She says, I'm tuning into Dana now, who says, to awaken the sleepers as we are already doing. However, the sun needs to be tempered with the veil, the cool waters of the understanding, the fire of love in activity by the feminine aspect of divinity. This understanding gives us intuition as to individual need. I have a glimpse of corn. I see mountains. I'm coming down. I love that, giving us intuition as to individual needs. It's no one formula. It's like that. There's this idea of bringing light, this idea of channeling, which again was something that was hugely, it was a sort of given as well, I think, here, that the spiritual world was using us, the meditations, the ceremonies we were doing, and the castle itself in some way, as a vehicle for some sort of energy to flow out into the world. You know, and that it's not just a question of trying to understand that intellectually, but each person will receive it in accordance with their need and in their own way. And then after the session on the following night, the 23rd of June, Olivia notes, I should like to emphasise that all these reports for these sessions are impressions. I have at odd times, never when I have tried to, received direct psychic vision and hearing, even when I have been physically conscious, eyes open. Also, I have, again always unexpectedly, received psychic experiences out of the body. The degree of reality of such experiences is completely different. Nonetheless, during these sessions, I believe I have been partly projected and have felt strong life flow. When I have received words and thoughts, I have felt this curious pressure at the back of my skull, which I have never had before. The level of reality is much the same as in my daily meditations. I seem happiest on the mental plane. I have some years ago had very brilliant, sharp colours of great beauty, but not during the last year or so. But vril is very strong with me. Vril was the term that Bulwer-Lytton used to talk about the life force. Vril is very strong with me. And then she puts in there, to be accurate, these sessions are stronger than my experiences during meditation. As strong as I can take. So you can, what's lovely about these, I think, is you can hear her thinking. She's saying, well, this is about as strong as my, and they said, no, actually they're not, they're stronger, and I can't take any more than this. You know. And so she will have been, in 71, she will have been, what, 54. So she was 54 years old.
And now, an excerpt from the penultimate session of that summer, in which Olivia receives information about the location here. There is an etheric sea here. Buried beneath this, as you have been told, is power magnetized in rock and earth. So are the holy hidden power centres of the Tuatha De Danann only opened when the time is due for their renewed use. So it is with this centre since 1946. What happened in 1946? Did the family come here in 46? Was the... Do we know why... Is 46 a key date in the story of...
Is that when Olivia moved back to the castle?
I don't know. Yes.
Did she not have some inspiration? Some guy spoke to her, or some initiation.
She had a vision of the. Was that last year? The vision of the play, and she looked at the stage and she saw a woman dressed in clothing as Isis, and then she realised that it was herself. I think that was that.
Oh right. Okay.
And then, and many years later, when she stood on the parliament stage of the Parliament of World Religions, she realised that was the vision.
Ah right. Yes.
I think it was around then.
Okay. Yes. And that's a lovely... Those stories are lovely, aren't they? Because we're so bound in time, aren't we? We think now that, you know, Olivia has died and Poppy and Derry have died and we're, you know, 40 years on from that moment by the kitchen table when seven people sat around. But you know, physicists tell us, Einstein tells us, that it's not like that at all. The time and space are strangely wrapped together, and if you watch those wonderful TED Talks on the computer, I can't understand them because they're so scientific, but time isn't linear in that way at all. It's all happening. Everything's happening at once in some strange way. Wonderful, liberating thought when we tune into that. And so she says, so it is with this centre since 1946. There are certain lines of force connecting this place, Glastonbury and Sligo. I see the sign of the six-pointed star, the Star of David, over Ireland. We are interconnected also with Brittany. And there is, for those of you, if anybody's been to to Brocéliande, see if you feel the same way. For me, it feels so similar. There's a sort of magic here that is, yeah, exactly. I see the diamond shape, four centres. This is primarily a receptive centre, the cult of the goddess. I need not be critical of this. It will be balanced from outside. It's interesting her saying that. I need not be critical of this. Almost suggesting that a part of her had been, perhaps. You know, I need not be critical of this. It will be balanced from the outside by a predominantly positive centre, possibly in the west of Ireland. I ask Olivia for more on the Glastonbury link. She replies, there is an etheric lake there where once was the Sea of Avalon. This is polarised by the power centre of the Tor. So it is with this centre here, for each centre has its inner polarity, balanced force. Our Rath, where the Protestant church stands and where Olivia is buried, the Druid burial ground, said to be the oldest in Europe, is the positive balance to our own place. Now, isn't that interesting? That's where she wanted to be.
We went down there today.
You were there today?
Yeah, we went down today.
Yes. Yes.
So it's probably quite important that we did. Just a few of us went down forward.
Just to link with that. And wasn't it wonderful when she was buried, when they lowered the coffin into the ground, there was that wonderful, there was a breeze and all these golden leaves just showered down. And then Julie Felix was playing, singing, and you know, the goddess in the palm of her hand. And so, yeah. Just lovely, absolutely lovely. And then finally, in the last session of that series, the seventh session, she receives an eloquent message from someone she calls the architect. And earlier on, she mentions Christopher Wren. And he says, harmony depends on proportion, whether it is of music, speech, or design. The faculty of man brings through this intimate knowledge, which is locked within the proportion of his own body, as in the cosmos at large. As is the greater, so is the lesser, in proportion. The microcosm reflects in miniature the macrocosm. So, in the matter of proportion, the divine signature is clearly seen. In this respect, all is created in God's image. All reflects in due proportion and scale this underlying harmony. The perfect modulation of part to whole, springing from unity, yet by harmonious adjustment, suited to particular place and purpose. This harmony is not to be marked out only by the measuring rod of classification,
but by knowledge of the innate beauty that is the product of love. And as I, Olivia, have understood from the myth of Psyche, Cupid and Psyche, soul and love, brought forth as child harmonia. Without this true knowledge, no work of art, no building, has that authority given it by the Creator. For no work of art, whether in stone, wood, or paint, can exist in living beauty without divine influx. That which is not in attunement with the divine proportion perishes, as it is not truly real. Isn't that fantastic? Just the language in that, the ideas that are being articulated with such clarity and eloquence, just superb. And so this last excerpt about harmony ties together rather beautifully two aspects of the Platonic triad I mentioned at the beginning, truth and beauty. But what about the third virtue, goodness? How was that encouraged? And this is where we come, I think, to the most important gift of all, so intangible, so hard to convey. But I think this is why my time at the castle was so life-changing, why those 9 months that I spent here became, for me, one of the most significant times in my life, which I will always treasure and always be grateful for. And I think that's because, in the final analysis, what was going on here, the gift that was being given, was the work of love, divine and human. I believe that Poppy, Derry and Olivia were quite simply motivated by love, unconditional love, which manifested as an immense generosity and which resulted in what we see around us today, a flourishing, colourful, creative movement informed by the search for those three virtues of goodness, truth and beauty. Long may the fellowship of Isis flourish and grow, blessed by the originality and genius of its founders, nourished now by the love and goodwill of all its members, and by the common sense and inspiration of those who are its guides and guardians. Thank you.